Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, of the making of books, there is no end. How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, I don't have any comments today to read, but I do have some comments I do want to talk to you about, but I want to wait till we get nearly finished with this chapter on Cairo. So to start off today's program, I want to read you a quote, and this is page 257 of the chapter titled Cairo. And I think this is really kind of a great way to begin this chapter of our view of the chapter. So this is talking about Lawrence as he was in Cairo. It says, busy as he was with map work and digesting intelligence reports into concise and useful documents for General Maxwell and Maxwell's staff, Lawrence described himself self-deprecatingly as bottle washer and office boy, pencil sharpener, and pen wiper. His view of the Middle East was inherently that of Cairo rather than that of Delhi. So I think by now all of us should understand that certainly Lawrence was being totally sarcastic there, and he definitely was not, you know, a bottle washer, office boy, pencil sharpener, or pen wiper. But I think the most important part of that statement was that his view of the Middle East was of the Cairo persuasion. Now, in our last program, we began our discussion of the British view of how to handle the Arab revolt against the Turks. And if you remember back to that program, one school was formed by the British military in Cairo. The other was from the British command in Delhi in India. And they were at odds over how the Arabs should be taken care of. So what we want to do today now is for this program, we want to continue our discussion of this vitally important chapter titled Cairo, 1914 to 1916. All you listeners out there, this is probably the most important chapter in Korda's book, and especially if you really want to understand the problems in today's Middle East. Now, to help me do this, James Brandon is here with me in the studio again today. Welcome back, James.
Good to be here.
So let's talk about this bottle washer, office boy, pencil sharpener, and pen wiper.
Lawrence has quite the dry sense of humor, I'm learning, the more I read this book. He like you said, definitely probably a sarcastic comment on his part, because he was pretty well connected, one of the most connected and most informed people there in the Middle East, quite likely.
Yes. Yeah. What I think is probably, like I said, he's just griping and complaining. And it's basically because he's not in a, you know, a suit of armor with his sword.
Right. He desperately wants to be a hero. I think he's a little jealous of his brothers at this point.
That's exactly right. But the thing is, I do think the way Korda portrays that is important, is that it's at this point in Lawrence's career where he feels like he and the British Empire are on the same page.
Right. There's some self-doubt and guilt that comes in a little later, even, you know, a few dozen pages later in this chapter. But right now, it seems like...
It seems like, you know, that the British seem to want to give the Arabs an Arab nation.
Yeah.
But it doesn't take many more paragraphs to realize that that's just not the case.
Not going to happen.
No, it's not going to happen. So, but I think it's important for us to realize, you know, when Lawrence makes certain statements about British colonialism, it doesn't mean that he's anti-empire. What it means is it's not happening the way he thinks empire should happen.
And, right.
You know, he very much in his life, and even in Seven Pillars of Wisdom, he really is very upset the way the British handled the Arab people.
Oh, yeah. I think he probably would have liked everyone to have been as informed and experienced with them as he was. I think he probably just felt that a lot of the people making big decisions about that didn't really know the people, didn't really know the lines of loyalty and the divisions, and probably just didn't really have the complete picture of what was going on in that area, not as complete as he did. And I don't think that's his arrogance coming through. I think that's legitimately his real experience, and he saw that they just didn't have that.
Yeah, I think this chapter brings out, well, of course, we're going to get into it, if not in this program, in the very next one. But it's definitely, I do believe that there are people that just weren't as informed as he was. I mean, he was really, if you really think about it, and we talked about this in other programs, he spent 4 years in Syria. I mean, as a young man, you know, working with the Arabs, listening to them, learning to speak their language, learning to understand their philosophies of life and their culture. And, you know, some of these other guys that came over from Parliament and came over from, you know, let's say the English, let's say maybe the British military officers that weren't really as well educated in other areas of the world, they came into the area, like into Cairo. They just didn't have that same understanding that he did. And it's not that they were liars. It's just they just didn't understand. But I do think that Lawrence did see there were a few that really did lie.
Oh, for sure. And I even think, I mean, definitely, like you said, I think there was some real intent to mislead. And there's, I think, a couple quotes we might talk about in a little bit that I think point that out. But even as far as what you were just saying about them not every British officer having the same level of experience in the region. And some of that is, I think, when a lot of those, you know, British officers would travel around in these areas, they were even mostly sticking with other British people. They were sticking in British areas. Whereas Lawrence, when he traveled in those 4 years that he spent in the Middle East, he sought out native experiences. He didn't want to stay on the beaten path. I mean, he did a walking tour through the Middle East on foot by himself.
Right.
You know, he really did expose himself to the actual country and the actual culture, whereas probably a lot of the other people, even though on paper they might have been to the same places, would not have had the same experiences.
No. And we're going to talk about, you know, some of these things as we go along here. But I think one point for our listeners out there, they have to be maybe well-educated enough to know about Lawrence that he was very aware of events in the Arab areas, more than anybody else. I mean, he really was the most informed about the Arab areas.
Yeah, he was tied in with everybody, really. Yeah. connected to anybody important. And if he wasn't connected to them directly, he was connected to them secondarily,
yes,
somehow through someone else.
Yeah, to me, that's just an amazing talent to be able to do that. I mean, he, you know, of course, we've talked about this before, where he had, you know, like, you know, Woolley helping him. He had Hogarth helping him. It just seemed like he just naturally fell in with the people that could really help move him along.
Right.
And even some of his original arch enemies, like Gertrude Bell, ended up being one of his big advocates.
Yeah.
Before it was all over.
She came to like him, or at least respect him.
And she was heavily involved in this, all of this as well.
I mean, oh, yeah. She was on this intelligence team there in Cairo.
She was on the team, but she was also sent out, you know, to work with the Arabs as advisors. And so it was really kind of remarkable. Maybe we could just talk for a few minutes about, let's say there were some problems with this Cairo intelligence office, and sometimes I've been involved in situations like this, and some ways still am involved in situations like this, where it's kind of like this Cairo office had three masters, and of course, they sent in Mark Sykes to help fix that. And of course, Mark Sykes is heavily involved in the Sykes-Picot agreement.
Right.
Now I understand that a whole lot better after reading this chapter than
yes.
I did before. But I've mentioned these names before to our listeners out there. So the three masters, or the three heads of this intelligence operation in Cairo, were Colonel Clayton, Sir Henry McMahon, and then Sir Reginald Wingate. And the thing is on one side of the coin, it's bad when you have three different people with three different sets of mind and thoughts. But if you look at the advantage for Lawrence, all of these men were supportive of him. He didn't have really anyone against him. I think even Earl Kitchener was basically for him. But what it did for him is it really did cause problems, let's say, especially the Cairo intelligence group with the Delhi intelligence group. They weren't getting along at all.
That's a really fascinating dynamic there as well,
right,
that we will probably get more into as well.
Yeah. So the point is that the thing that this really did for Lawrence, it really gave him a broad view because all of them were his confidants.
Right.
So what Clayton knew, Lawrence knew. What McMahon knew, Lawrence knew. What Reginald Wingate knew, Lawrence knew.
Which is fascinating, too, because we mentioned this last program, I believe, that he really wasn't a very high-ranking officer.
Second lieutenant, and had
been pretty hastily appointed not that long before this.
And he was 5'5".
Yeah, and here he is, really tied into, you know, three very high-ranking men with direct ties back to the War Office. And
to Kitchener.
And they all trust him. They all talk to him. There's a line in the book that says that the attitude or the words escaping me, but basically the experience there in that intelligence unit was more of an sort of Oxford debate room rather than a secret spy master's organization. There was just a lot of open communication between all these people. And that was part of why Lawrence was always so well informed, because these men were in direct communication with the War Office and then also just in open communication with Lawrence about the things that they're talking about with, you know, the top guys.
Right. And then add to the fact that Lawrence was a good friend of all the Arab nationalist leaders.
So he knows information from both sides.
Both sides. Right.
Which wound up putting him in a really difficult position down the road.
Exactly. Yeah. So you can just see that. I guess the point is, I'm just trying to say, is that he really was well informed. I mean, he certainly wasn't viewed as a bottle washer, office boy, pencil sharpener, and pen wipe.
No, I think he was a very valued part of that office.
Yes. Well, here's what Korda says. This is at the top of page 258 for anybody out there. I'll try and read this accurately. It says, as a result, Lawrence was one of the best informed persons in Cairo. He made, corrected, and pieced together maps. He interrogated Turkish prisoners of war. He kept a record of the positions and the movements of each division of the Turkish army. He wrote and produced, with Graves, the official handbook of the Turkish army for the use of officers, and he was in constant telegraphic communication with London, Paris, St. Petersburg, and Khartoum. His keenness, energy, and capacity for hard work drew people's attention, as did his superior tone and his determination to impose his opinion on other people, however much higher in rank or more experienced they were. So as far as he was concerned, he was the most important person.
Oh, yeah.
There.
The smartest one, for sure.
Yeah, and not the bottle washer.
No.
And pencil sharpener and pen wiper.
Maybe that comment was made out of some frustration that he didn't feel his talents were being used to their full capacity. Yeah. But.
And I think, as I mentioned at the beginning, I think his main frustration really was he wasn't a warrior yet.
Right. And he had those two brothers that were soldiers that wound up dying, you know, later on. And he was the youngest.
Yeah.
And so I think that hit him pretty hard. And, you know, just as much as he really idolized that heroic lifestyle, I think being a map maker and report writer didn't fulfill him like he wanted to be fulfilled.
No. And he got his uniform from the Army Navy store. It wasn't tailor made for him. But I think just another little aside, and we're not going to spend a lot of time on that. The thing is he was somewhat of a control freak.
Oh yes.
And the thing is on the maps he had to make sure that every name was exactly the same.
Right.
For the Arabs, how you spell it. But the point is, when he wrote Seven Pillars of Wisdom, he didn't care.
He didn't care.
Yeah. Because he was just trying to control everybody.
It was just a way to exert some power within the office.
Yeah. I think one of the other big things, and again, maybe we could talk about this just a little bit. One of the other things that because he was in the intelligence area, he did know that the Arab nationalists had really been in touch with the British high officials in Cairo even before Turkey entered the war. And this was really a pretty delicate situation because the Brits and the Turks were still at peace with each other. So he knew that these secret talks were going on. And he knew that there were people in the military that supported a Arab uprising before they were even at war with Turkey. I mean, people saw that as important, but it wasn't important. They saw the importance of it, but it wasn't important for the Arabs. It was important for the British.
Right. It was like we talked about in the last program, I believe the British were looking at this area of the world and seeing some valuable resources. And I mean, the empire colonized, that's what they did. And you know, we're not here to talk about empire and colonization, but that's what they were doing. And they were looking at an area where the Turks had influence and Britain wanted to have influence.
That's right.
And so, you know, how do you do that? We've seen that happen in the last, well, I mean, very recently in the last 10 years in the Middle East, but going back to the 1970s as well.
Right.
You know, how do you shake up the balance of power in an area?
Yeah.
You incite an uprising.
Yeah, that's right. It's the world is a cruel place.
Oh, yeah.
It's just evil.
And I think that's where, you know, some of Lawrence's guilt came from, is that he recognized what Britain's interests were and why they were interested, and he also knew what the Arabs wanted, and he knew that the ones that would get caught in the middle were the people that he had spent time with.
Right.
You know,
and he also knew what the French wanted.
Oh yeah.
And he didn't like that either.
No. Well, nobody liked what the French wanted except for the French.
So maybe to help make this simple for our listeners, if you can reduce this Cairo interest and the Delhi interest into two basic things, is here you have the British Empire in India, and they would go through these periods of floods and droughts, and so they had famine.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Iraq and Iran could provide the grain that they needed in India.
Right.
Well, Britain was converting from coal as their fuel source to oil, and they also wanted to protect the Suez Canal, so they had an easy access to India.
Mm-hmm.
You know, between you know, coming through the Mediterranean, you know, through the Suez Canal, and then over into I guess it's the Arabian Sea and the Indian, and I think it's the Indian Ocean and the Arabian Sea. They could get quick access to Delhi,
right?
And so that was the basic tension on who was going to really control. And, you know, to me, it's kind of amazing. Why couldn't they work together?
Right. You're talking about ostensibly the same empire.
Yeah.
And some of the extra reading outside of what's in the book that I did about this, it is amazing, especially Delhi, because they made some moves and really acted independently in their own interests. And that's really fascinating to me because it's an empire. It's, I guess, kind of, as someone who didn't live in that time, it's kind of hard to wrap your head around because it seems like, well, you're the same country in a way.
Yeah.
Like you're the same, you should have the same interests, but the powers that be in India were making moves that were preempting things that they were trying to do in Cairo, just basically acting unilaterally.
Yeah,
in their own self-interest.
Yeah, it's almost like New Mexico wanting to have access to Oklahoma,
right?
And Texas for the cows, Oklahoma for the grain,
right?
You know,
and just decide this is what we're gonna do.
Yeah, we're just gonna take over Oklahoma.
Yeah,
you know? So to me that's funny, but I get, not funny. It's really sad in a way that there isn't even within the empire there wasn't unity.
Well, we point to World War I, too, as really the beginning of the end for the empire.
Right.
And maybe this is just one symptom of that, where there wasn't really a unified strategy. I mean, we're talking about two branches of the same government that were fighting against each other.
And it's also, I think it shows where the monarchy was falling. I mean, why couldn't they have stepped in and said, hey, you two, get involved. You know, get together on this. But I think one thing that Corder brings out about this whole thing is that neither side of the British views understood the Arab thinking.
Right.
The people in Delhi were afraid that if they had an Arab uprising, all the Muslims in India would uprise. Well, when an uprising happened, nothing happened in India.
Right.
You know, they were afraid of the same thing happening in Egypt. Well, when the uprising started, nothing happened in Egypt either. So it shows how even the Arabic peoples are complacent.
Right.
You know, kind of thing. But there was one man that really understood it, and that's what Corder brings out, and it was Lawrence.
Right.
You know, and so what a... And I think Churchill began to see this about him, but he was really an ace in the hand of the British.
Yeah, just his knowledge, and not only his knowledge, I think it's easy to talk about someone knowing a lot about a subject, but the difference, I think, with Lawrence is that, yes, he knew a lot, but he was also liked and respected.
Right.
So it wasn't just that he had a lot of book knowledge or a lot of, intellectual knowledge about this region. Really, everything that he knew from experience.
Right.
And he was also close with many of these people and well-respected by many of them. I mean, he had been the boots on the ground talking to these people and developing relationships with these people. So you compare him to someone like Sykes, who we'll talk about later. Sykes had been to all the same places on paper. To the people back in Britain, he seemed just as qualified, if not more so. But he just didn't know.
But it was more like he was there's that the very popular travel guy, something like Stevens Europe or something.
Rick Steves.
Yeah, Rick Steves Europe. And sorry, Rick Steve, if you're listening. I'm not trying to make fun of you, but it was almost like Mark Sykes. Arabia.
He just traveled around. He'd been a tourist, but he didn't.
Right.
He didn't know the region.
He actually wrote a tour guide.
Yeah, he did. That's right.
I think we need to be a little bit fair to the British Empire as well. I mean, here we are, Americans talking about the British Empire. They would, and I know there are people in Britain listening to the program. We really do love Britain. And I do buy my clothes from Charles Tyrwhitt in London. But anyway, the thing is it would have been really hard for them to know if the Arab nationalists could really be strong enough to fight the Turks.
I think they just never really had any faith in them.
Yes, and so you can understand where they would like go into kind of drop. We'll talk nation,
mm-hmm.
But they didn't really know what was going to happen until after, the Turks blew it with the Suez Canal, and then of course there was the whole thing with the Dardanelles, which we've talked on the radio a lot of times. But then the Arab nationalists stood up and they actually beat the pants off the Turks.
Right.
And so, then it began to get, well, maybe this could be real, Also, I think even the Arab nationalists were a little concerned because, as Corder brings out, Abdullah, Sharif's second son, Emir Abdullah, knew that the Turks were probably going to assassinate his father because they didn't trust them,
They recognized that he was, as far as figures there in the Middle East, he was one that people would look to. I mean, not that you could never unify them all of those different peoples behind one person, but if there was anyone that a lot of people would look to, it was someone from that Sharifian family.
Yeah, because they were related to Muhammad. And,
right.
And,
they're in Mecca. And
they were in Mecca, and they also knew the desert. And
actually, and they understood what the Arab people wanted. They knew the importance of Damascus and Aleppo.
Damascus and Syria.
Yeah.
And, of course, they wanted that. you know, Syria to them was that whole coastline.
Oh, yeah.
Of the Mediterranean, which they really felt they needed to have a country.
Mm-hmm.
And so even Korda brings out it really wasn't an empty threat on the part of the Arab nationalists, because the one son was supposed to be in the Turkish parliament, but he was actually being held hostage.
Right, in Turkey.
In Turkey. And so they did. The Turks did not trust the Hussein family, and there's a lot of things in there, listeners, that you have to understand. And the point is the Middle East really, I mean, from my understanding of the book, James can agree or disagree with me, but because of some of all these things going on, the Middle East was really sloppily put together.
Oh, yeah. There's a line in the book that's not from Korda. He's quoting from someone else. I think it's on, page 279. So it's a little further along than where we are right now. But he talks about basically the Middle East was carved up by a careless butcher.
Right.
I mean, that's what we see today. The divisions and what we see today are all, you know, it's not exactly the way that it was intended to be, you know. Things there were, we'll talk more about that, I'm sure, when we talk about Sykes-Picot and what happened after that. But the way that we see the Middle East today, the countries, the boundary lines that we see, even the people that live there don't feel that those are natural lines.
No, and there's a lot of foment still in the Arabic peoples because of it. Well, we're out of time for today's program. So next time, we will continue our discussion of Lawrence at Cairo. But we're going to specifically get into the Sykes-Picot Pact. I think that will really help really clear a lot of these things up. So remember, for this current series of programs, we're using Michael Korda's book, Hero, The Life and Legend of Lawrence of Arabia. It is a fantastic book. And if you want to understand the modern Middle East today and the problems that we're facing and the powder keg it's actually going to be here pretty quick, you can buy this book at Amazon.com. You can find a used copy of the book at abebooks.com. And, of course, you can also check your local library. So please write me any comments you may have to JBL at pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And so until next time, keep reading.
Been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.